This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. For many conservatives, the death of Terry Schiavo was the last straw. House Majority Leader Tom DeLay declared that the judges who refused to hear the case would be called to answer. Another Texas Republican, Senator John Cornyn, said that frustration with the courts may help explain recent attacks on judges in Georgia and Illinois. Pointing to Terry Schiavo, gay marriage, abortion, limits on the death penalty, and other issues, activists say that the judicial branch must be brought into line with Congress, the president, and public opinion. Defenders of the courts, including many Republicans, point to the Constitution, which provides an independent judiciary to balance and sometimes check the power of the chief executive and the legislature. On the eve of a conference to discuss how to rein in what some are calling a runaway judiciary, we'll look at judges, politics, and the Constitution. Later in the program, legislation passes in Maryland to require Walmart to provide health care coverage for its employees or pay the state to do it. And forget missile silos in Siberia. Now a satellite picture of your house is just a click away. But first, the controversy over the courts. What is the proper role of the judiciary? Should federal judges face election or term limits or some kind of periodic review? And how does this play into the congressional fight over the confirmation of judicial nominees? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Our first guest is William Green, the president of RightMarch.com, and he joins us now from the studios of Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks for having me on.
You're organizing a two-day conference that starts tomorrow, not merely to protest, but to, according to your website, to come up with a plan of action. What are you hoping to come up with?
Well, what we're hoping to do is actually a number of different things. This particular conference is going to be covering a lot of different issues. It's going to be covering judicial activism. It's going to be covering judicial nominations. It's going to be covering the constitutional issues of the judiciary. It's going to be covering just a number of different approaches. It's going to be covering a lot of grassroots activism, which is what I'm going to be focusing on. So one of the things that we're trying to accomplish here is to really bring together a lot of the folks that have been working on the issue of judicial activism and judicial supremacy for quite a while now, and bring us all together so that we can talk about this, so that we can discuss what course of action needs to be taken by leaders and by people across the nation.
So assembling different groups to form a coalition.
Exactly. I mean, there's a lot of organizations, especially conservative organizations, that have been working on the issue of judicial activism and the judiciary in general for some time. But what we haven't been able to do is have a real concerted effort working together across the spectrum of organizations. And so that's one of the things that this particular conference we hope will accomplish.
And what's your definition of what the problem is?
I think the probably the biggest problem that we have, I mean, we've heard about judicial activism for quite some time mm-hmm. now, the concept of legislating from the bench and so forth, instead of simply interpreting law, interpreting the Constitution as it's written, basing things on original intent and the construction of the Constitution itself, legislating from the bench. In other words, determining what you want the outcome to be and then making your decision based on that and based on, you know, changing values and mores instead of the actual foundation of Constitution and law itself. But I think one of the key issues that we're going to need to address most of all right now is this concept of judicial supremacy. Under the U.S. Constitution, we do have separation of powers. We have three co-equal branches of government. In mm-hmm. fact, the judiciary was originally envisioned by the Founding Fathers to not even be co-equal, to have less power than the other two branches. But even with a co-equal sharing of power and the checks and balances that exist, what we've come to today is, for some reason, this understanding on the part of a lot of people, and especially on the part of a lot of judges, of judicial supremacy, that the courts have the last word in everything no matter what, and that if the executive branch and the legislative branches, they don't like that, that's just too bad. The courts reign supreme. And that's really an issue that needs to be addressed and needs to be confronted head on.
And if that's not the case, then Isn't the complaint then with Governor Bush and President Bush, who failed to take executive action to intervene, for example, in the Terri Schiavo case?
Well, in fact, that is one of the complaints that we had. We were RightMarch.com was very active in the Terri Schiavo situation. We were especially active in Tallahassee. We led a large group of folks that were lobbying the state senators there and lobbying Governor Bush there to take the action that they had capability of under the Florida Constitution. The state legislature failed to do so, and then Governor Bush failed to do so, and we were very disappointed in that. But in fact, the biggest thing that they failed to do was to stand up to, in this particular case within the state system, to stand up to a state judge that had declared himself to be the supreme executive power of Florida in this situation, and that he wasn't going to listen to anyone else, he wasn't going to do what anyone else said, and he wasn't going to really follow the Constitution of the state of Florida. And then when we moved up to the federal level with the federal judge that refused to go along with what Congress had been very explicit about, and that was to review the case de novo
from the beginning,
from scratch, to look at all the facts of the case and not just the process, not just those things that had gone before in the previous cases, but to look at all the everything from scratch. Well, the judge didn't do it and refused to do it, in fact, and I think that's what was so frustrating to Congressman DeLay.
Well, he refused, and then the appeals court refused, and then the Supreme Court refused, all three of them three times.
I think that just points up one of the big problems we have here, and that is you've got a situation where judges are very hesitant to review what other judges have already decided. Mm-hmm. However, when Congress has been very, and the president, were very explicit about allowing a de novo review of this case, which should have taken place because you had a state judge that had a lot of bias in the situation and was and refused to look at new evidence, refused to look at new technology, refused to look at anything new.
Well, so this
federal court, that's one of the situations in America, is that whenever we have someone who basically has been condemned to death, if new evidence or new technology arises, then that person should have due process rights to have their case reviewed de novo. And in this particular case, Congress had explicitly put that forth for this judge to do so, and he refused to do so.
I don't want to get there are many other issues besides Terri Schiavo, but
yes.
On that one case, national polls show that the majority of Americans supported the judiciary's decisions in the Terri Schiavo case and objected to the idea of Congress butting in.
Well, I don't know if you've seen what the news that came out in the last day or so, but it turns out actually that the polls that were proposed there, and especially the ABC poll that was the main poll that continually was quoted over and over,
mm-hmm.
Were the questions were incredibly biased against life for Terri Schiavo, and I mean it's actually been gone over and over the bias that was inherent in those poll questions. When the poll questions were asked in a much less biased fashion, for example, the Zogby poll that was taken just before Terri Schiavo died, that has now been released, the poll results actually showed that the majority of the American people were very much opposed to someone like Terri Schiavo having their food and water removed and being starved to death. And in fact, a plurality were in favor of the congressional action that was taken.
Well, today the New York Times reported Senator Bill Frist, the Senate Majority Leader, believes, quote, we have a fair and independent judiciary, end quote. He's declined to investigate any of the judges involved in the Schiavo case. Are you getting any support from Congress on this?
We are from different congressmen and different senators. However, there's a hesitation, obviously, on the part of folks that are more entrenched in power, that they don't want to mess with the system at all. But it's time now that things have to be looked at in a much more clear fashion. With the fact that we have judges, I mean, a state judge, a lower state judge in Florida, being able to actually defy a congressional subpoena, that's unheard of. And then for Congress to not do anything about that, well, the fact is, what we have is some politicians who need to develop some spines and stand up to this type of judicial activism.
800-989-8255 if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 800-989-TALK. Email is TOTN at NPR.org. And let's talk with Fred. Fred's calling from La Grande, Oregon.
Thank you for taking my call. Yes, I can point out a Republican politician that's got some spine. How about Representative Christopher Shays and all of his colleagues in the moderate wing of the Republican Party who stood up for states' rights, who stood up for federal deference to well-settled practices of the state courts. Republican political philosophy, all the way back from Lincoln, has consistently expressed and championed discretion in private family matters and given to the states and the state courts deference. And I think it's just reprehensible as a Republican that the nationalist wing of the Republican Party has gotten so activism. It's almost like a mirror image of FDR activism in court packing. Certainly the speaker is woefully incorrect about the primary role of the federal judiciary. In the final analysis, the federal judiciary interprets the law. And in Judge Greer in Florida, that took 6 or 7 days of testimony from all different kinds of experts on Terry Schiavo's persistent vegetative state. And as a Republican, I champion the family and family values. But absent some kind of fraud or criminal intent, you have to have, under Florida state law, the primacy of the spouse's decision over the family. I mean, that's state law and state's rights. And you can't have it both ways.
Fred, this is an interesting point, but we're running out of time in the segment. I'm going to put you on hold, okay?
Thank you.
I'm going to put you on hold. And can you stay with us for a couple of minutes, William Green?
Absolutely.
All right. So we're going to hang on to both of these people through the break. And if you'd like to get involved in the conversation, the number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is William Green, president of rightmarch.com, who's organizing a two-day conference on judicial activism to be held here in Washington tomorrow and the next day. I'm Neil Conan. Back after the break, you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the judicial branch of government. Recent rulings on high-profile cases in the culture wars have many conservatives up in arms about what they call activist judges and a runaway judiciary. Our guest is William Green, president of rightmarch.com. And just before the break, we were on the line with a caller, Fred, who's with us from La Grande, Oregon, who identified himself as a Republican. And William Green, who said, states' rights, you can't have this issue both ways.
Well, in fact, it's really not an issue of states' rights at all. What Congress did in trying to save Terry Schiavo's life was part of a long-standing judicial tradition in America for federal courts to review cases where 14th Amendment rights, specifically due process rights, may have been violated. And so this was not an issue of violating states' rights. I've been getting a real kick lately out of folks that very rarely use the question of states' rights, in fact, are usually opposed to states' rights, bringing up this issue of states' rights. But I'm appreciative when I'm appreciative when a Republican brings it up, because the mainstream media has really pushed this out there as being the federal government stepping onto the feet of the state government, when in fact it's simply part of a long-standing judicial tradition in this country of again federal courts being able, having the ability to step in and review cases and intervene where 14th Amendment due process rights have been denied, and that's what happened with Terry Schiavo.
And what about the federal courts after the members of Congress came back on Palm Sunday? You know, several hundred stayed home, but half the Democrats went along, you know, out of political expediency with the Republican majority and passed that special Terry Schiavo bill. And then during the week, it went all the way up through the federal courts. You guys on the right, you're
well,
happy
it went up
with
the federal courts, but it didn't actually go through the federal courts in the way that the Congress had specified that it was to be going through the federal
because
courts.
Because it was a matter of state. It's well settled. Certainly,
I'm not sure you're a lawyer, but I know Mr. Green is not. So I'm not sure.
But I did sleep in a Holiday Inn last night.
I'm not a lawyer, but I used to be. But it still is a fairly straightforward.
No, but I used to teach constitutional law, and this is actually a very well established facet of constitutional law that federal courts are able to review through because if there's 14th Amendment due process rights being violated, and so that's what happened with Terry Schiavo, and that's what Congress gave the capability for it to go from the state court to the federal court level, and that's what this federal judge denied. It's not a matter of it went up through the federal courts.
In fact, it didn't
go up through the federal courts the way that it had been laid out for it to be able to do constitutionally.
Fred, we're not going to resolve this question between the two of you here at this moment. So,
can I make one last comment?
You may.
Yes, the federal judge who took the Palm Sunday ruling issued a ruling on five different points about whether the family was going to prevail, and the ultimate decision, which came down in this, was decided correctly. The next of kin, the legal next of kin, which was the spouse, family values, protect the marriage. They had a legal valid marriage, and they didn't let the family members, the blood family members,
but
trump
that
the
wasn't
spouse
what. Congress,
should have been, and that's
but
what
that wasn't what Congress
Shays
had specified in the Palm Sunday legislation. The judge did not do the de novo review that the legislation had specified that he was empowered to do.
And we're going to leave the argument there. Fred, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And
thank you, Fred.
We also want to thank William Green for joining us today. We appreciate your time today.
Absolutely. I'm sure we could spend a lot more time on this.
Thank you again. William Green is president of RightMarch.com and joined us from the studios of Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Now, to help us better understand the role of the federal judiciary, we turn to Doug Kamek, chair and professor of constitutional law at Pepperdine University in Malibu, California. He's with us by phone from his office there. Good to talk with you, Doug.
Hi, Neil.
What do you make of this argument, this idea of the runaway judiciary?
Well, the argument's been around for a long time. Some of it has legitimacy, some of it does not. There is a casualness, and it's an unfortunate casualness, about the use of the term judicial activist. I think Frank Easterbrook, a judge on the Seventh Circuit some years ago, said it has a tendency to mean you don't like the outcome. Certainly there is a good number of people who are distressed by the outcome in the Terry Schiavo case, as we've just heard. But I think it's an entirely separate question as to whether or not the judges followed the law. In my judgment, they did. The general doctrine is that federal district and circuit courts lack jurisdiction to review the final judgments of state courts. And while there are extraordinary circumstances where those judgments are overturned, they are truly extraordinary, and they are legislated under general enactments that prospectively apply and not particular laws that are drafted to dictate or impose a particular rule of decision in a particular case.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think we have to separate our distress with a particular outcome from whether or not the courts are out of control.
And what do you make then also of the accompanying, and again, passions are high at the moment, but there have been calls for either to impeachments of sitting judges or restructuring a federal judgeship somehow to get around the idea that these judges are simply not responsive?
Well, the Constitution operates on a design, and the design is the separation of powers. And most of the power under the Constitution, by that design, is placed in the people, in their representatives, or by means of amendment, or in the executive by means of implementation. And indeed, Alexander Hamilton thought the judiciary would be the least dangerous branch because it had neither power of purse nor power of enforcement, power of coercion. But this much is true. The Supreme Court has loomed large in our modern culture, and sometimes it has read into the text of the Constitution things that many people quite credibly would say are not there and dispute and would suggest should be resolved in the political process. We have a political process to check the court. It's called constitutional amendment. We have a political process to check the court. It allows Congress, at least in some cases, to withdraw aspects of the court's appellate jurisdiction It seems to me that the appropriate place to raise specific concerns about court judgments is through one of those mechanisms and not to brandish impeachment or threaten other penalties in that manner.
Mm-hmm. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Jeff. Jeff's calling from Tallahassee.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
Yeah, I would like to know, I'd like to ask Mr. Green, we keep hearing this hyperbole about judicial activism. What about executive activism? We have the President of the United States and the Attorney General of the United States saying that the Geneva Convention does not apply to the United States, attempting to cut off Article 3 review of executive decisions. So I think we have an equal problem with executive activism, and I would just like to hear the Mr. Green's comments as to that.
Well, Mr. Green has left us, so we're here with Doug Kamek, who's a constitutional scholar at
Equally
Pepperdine
great.
University.
That would be wonderful.
Okay, thanks very much. Doug?
Well, substituting then, my sense is that the caller is right to raise a question about whether an executive is staying within the scope of his authority. And we do rely upon the courts to check the executive when he makes claims that are more beyond the scope of his authority. And so, for example, in the last term of the Supreme Court, the president claimed a fairly sweeping authority to detain enemy combatants, and he got part of what he asked for. The court confirmed that under limited circumstances, those detentions are appropriate, but they also have to be accompanied by due process protections, or at least due process protections that are modified for the circumstance of a nation at war. So in that particular instance, I think we were well served by, in essence, a dynamic between the executive and the court, a dynamic in which the executive had to explain himself. And I think your caller is suggesting that there are questions that are still afoot with regard to those being detained in Guantanamo, and those indeed are being raised before the district courts in Washington and are now on appeal to the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. So I think the Constitution in this instance is working exactly as designed.
Mm-hmm. How much, and again, let's take the Terry Schiavo instance out of this, in just to talk in general, how much are judges supposed to take public opinion into account? A little, a lot, not at all?
There's a few places where the court has suggested that the public opinion as manifested in particularly objective ways, such as in the death penalty context, where public opinion has manifested itself in states repealing or modifying its death penalty practices, that should affect the interpretation of the Eighth Amendment. That in itself is quite controversial, and not every member of the court certainly agrees with that. So I would say, Neil, that it's exceptional when public opinion is directly seen as a source of authority for the court to resolve cases. The court has enough to do to interpret the text and history and context of the constitutional words or the words of a federal statute, and it's to be guided by that original understanding of the Constitution or by the intent of the Congress as it existed when it passed a statute. And so to the extent that public opinion was incorporated in that legislative intent, then the court has to pay attention, but it can't just read the Zogby poll or the Gallup poll or listen to NPR and get a good insight on these things and then apply it in a case or controversy.
Okay. Let's get one more caller in. Chip is with us from Hartford, Connecticut.
Yes, hi. I just want to take that same argument and ask if it can be extended, because my view has always been that the role of the judiciary is to protect us from the majority. It's to protect the rights of the minority. And almost by definition, some of the rulings of the court are going to be opposed to the public opinion or opposed to the rule of the majority.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a crucial, crucial balance. And this notion of trying to change the court to reflect the majority will, today perhaps hurt one person and tomorrow will perhaps hurt the same people who are now trying to take it apart. Isn't there any realization of that?
Well, I think there is a realization of that, and it's a nice point. One of the reasons why FDR was an extremely popular president in 1936, had just won by a landslide, and when he attempted to pack the court in a way that he thought would help the nation in dire economic distress, even that economic distress was not enough to justify the attempt, and it was soundly condemned. And so too today, I think, trying to judge judicial candidates on the basis of ideology is foolhardy, both because it doesn't anticipate the future well enough, it certainly can't predict it well enough, and it leaves unexamined qualities of people, such as their temperateness, their capacity to know the law, their capacity to apply fairly previous legal standards and precedents, which are far more important to examine as part of the advice and consent process.
Chip, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And Doug Kamek, as always, thank you for your time.
Neil, nice to be with you.
Doug Kamek, Chair and Professor of Constitutional Law at Pepperdine University in Malibu, California, with us from his office there. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Charles Babington is congressional reporter for The Washington Post. He's been following the debate in Congress over the judiciary, and he joins us now by phone from Capitol Hill. Nice to speak with you.
Good to be here, Neil.
Is this story going anywhere?
The story in terms of the Terry Schiavo influence or the judicial nominations?
First of all, let's get about this idea of the runaway judiciary.
Well, you know, that's a good question. There's definitely a group of conservatives, particularly in the House, that are very concerned about this, and they have quite a spokesman in Tom DeLay, who, of course, is the House Majority Leader, the second-ranking leader in the House. I don't think if you really, they have a total majority in the body, and also there's there's less concern about this on the Senate side, where I think there's a greater feeling, let's kind of move on to other things. But in fact, some of these members, including DeLay, have been talking about this for quite some time and have repeatedly threatened to impeach judges or reduce the numbers of courts or the number of judges on these courts. And yet, those things obviously have not happened. The impeachments that have happened had nothing to do with politics. So.
Yeah.
I would say it's probably an uphill battle for them, but it's not something that they seem eager to turn loose of.
Now, on that other point, how much of this is about these other cases, gay marriages and abortion and Terry Schiavo, and how much of it is about the ongoing debate over judicial nominations in the Senate?
Well, they get all kind of mixed up, Neil, in a somewhat complicated way. One point to keep in mind is that only the Senate has a role in confirming or rejecting judges, so the House is left out of that. In some ways, that frees the House members perhaps to be more outspoken, perhaps, or to pay less attention. You could look at it either way, since they don't really have a role in that. I do think one thing it does, however, is because you've got this situation, this really impasse in the Senate over a number of judicial nominees, and this is the filibustering of these nominees, and because that seems to be coming to some type of head, which could be quite a collision, that it sort of everything is ramped up. All these issues in some ways are more emotional or have more resonance because of that context.
Now, as we quoted Senator Frist earlier saying, look, there is a fine judiciary out there, doesn't see any need for this. He seems to be distancing himself from this issue, but does this put more pressure on him, again, in the judicial nominations context, to invoke what some call the nuclear option?
I don't think you're quite right about Frist wanting to put some distance, and I think that's in part because he's got so many other problems to deal with. And so I think he and some of his fellow Republicans in the Senate are sort of saying, look, guys, let's move on to something else here. And that, you know, one of the big things they have is what to do about this impasse over the judges. I don't think in the final analysis the Schiavo case will play a big role in that. There are some conservatives who are very unhappy about the judiciary's role in the Schiavo case, and they're saying, see, you know, that's evidence that we need more conservative judges on the bench. But I really think that there are so many issues already in place, and you mentioned some of the gay marriage, what have you, and this goes back for years and years and years, the question of whether you have, you know, an activist, overly activist judiciary, that there were already enough of those types of arguments to really animate this debate in the Senate.
And briefly, do you get any sense of any, some people argue that the Governor Bush or President Bush should have intervened if there's going to be a problem from the right against those conservatives who didn't act enough in some people's view?
You mean take action with it with the judiciary itself? Well, you know, you could say that both the governor and the president took rather extraordinary actions doing what they did. You know, Jeb Bush had earlier in the Schiavo case had intervened and gotten the feeding tube through his actions, you know, replaced one time. And then, of course, President Bush, as we know, flew back from Crawford, Texas, a rather extraordinary event on Palm Sunday, ended up being the morning after Palm Sunday, in the middle of the night, signed the legislation that Congress had passed in an extraordinary Sunday session.
And Charles Babington, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you, though, very much.
Thank you.
Charles Babington of The Washington Post from Capitol Hill. When we get back, Maryland and Walmart and healthcare. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.